he said. Thank you for bringing the chicken. She felt oddly formal with him, like he was a guest in her home.
Thank you for cooking it.
He was being just as proper with her. They had become strangers.
You've been well?
She nodded and moved across the kitchen to uncork one of the 2 dozen remaining bottles of wine they had. Marcel had kept a small collection before the war. She poured a glass for him and one for her, and they toasted. To peace, she said.
To victory.
His reply was immediate.
Peace without victory means nothing.
She nodded and turned away, sure he was scolding her.
I'm sorry, he said. I didn't mean that as a criticism. I... sometimes things come out wrong.
It's all right. She was surprised to realize she meant it.
And I am sorry, too, about the baby, Ruby. I really am.
The words hung between them, and he waited until she looked up before continuing.
I feel very sorry that he died. You needed me, and I wasn't there for you. I haven't been there for you much at all, in fact. But things will be different soon, I promise.
Does that mean you'll be able to tell me what's going on? Maybe let me help? His smile faded.
We've discussed this, Ruby. It would put you in danger.
He raised his glass again.
But I want to become once again the man you married. I will, Ruby. I will.
They toasted, looking into each other's eyes, and for a long time afterward, as she sipped her wine, Ruby could see the hazy possibility of a different future. Marcel left after dinner, thanking Ruby politely for the meal and promising to be back soon. 2 hours later, Ruby had delivered some soup to the Dachets and was just finishing scrubbing dishes when there was a knock at the door, so tentative that at first she wondered if she'd imagined it. But then she heard it again, stronger this time. Ruby's eyes went to the clock. It was past curfew. A chill ran down her spine as she considered the possibility that it was a Nazi soldier here to arrest Marcel for whatever he was doing. But when she peered out the peephole, it wasn't a German uniform she saw. It was what appeared to be a greenish-gray jumpsuit, and the man wearing it, dark blonde hair, 6 feet tall or so, was bent down on one knee in the hall, breathing heavily. Ruby backed away from the door, puzzled. A moment later, he knocked again, and when she didn't answer, there was a pause, and then she heard a series of strange noises from the hall. It took her a few seconds to recognize the sounds as sobs. The man began to mumble to himself, and she inched closer to the door, hoping she could catch a few words. She nearly fell back when she realized he wasn't speaking French or even German. He was speaking English.
Have to get to, he was muttering. They said it was here.
Before she could second-guess herself, she pulled the door open. The man nearly lost his balance, tripping into her apartment before scrambling to his feet and backing away.
Oh, I'm so sorry, miss. I'm sorry. Je suis désolé.
He trailed off, apparently unable to remember the final syllable in the French apology.
I'm just really sorry, miss. I don't speak much French.
Who are you? She asked in English, which seemed to startle him.
You speak English. Oh, thank heavens. Dexter. My name is Dexter. And, forgive me, but I've been walking for 2 days and I haven't had anything to eat at all, and I'm afraid that the small wound I have on my shoulder has perhaps gotten a bit infected, so...
You're British. He nodded again.
And you? You're not French, are you?
She didn't reply. What are you doing here, Dexter? He hesitated, which was just long enough to make up her mind. She didn't know how he had arrived at her front door, but she had the feeling it had something to do with Marcel. And in the time that Dexter had been babbling, she had spotted the RAF patches on his chest. He was a British pilot, or at least, he was dressed as one. And that meant that both of them would be in danger if anyone saw them together.
Well, miss, you see, I was flying over northeast France, or at least I thought I was, when...
Come in, she interrupted, quickly, before someone spots you. He blinked a few times.
Thank you. Thank you so much, miss. I... She grabbed his right arm and pulled him inside, but as she began to hurriedly close the door behind him, she realized she was already too late. Charlotte was down the hall, in the sliver of her own open doorway, staring at Ruby and the British pilot, her mouth open in an O of surprise. Ruby could feel the blood draining from her face, but she managed to put a finger to her lips. "Tell no one," she mouthed to Charlotte. "Please." Silently, Charlotte nodded and slipped back into her own apartment, closing the heavy door behind her. Chapter 11. August 1941. Ruby was helping Allied airmen? Charlotte stood with her back to the door for a long time. Her apartment was silent, her parents in bed. She'd heard a commotion in the hall and had gone to the door to investigate. Perhaps it was Monsieur Benoit up to no good again, she'd thought. If she could see what he was doing, she would have something to share with Ruby. But instead, when she peered out, she realized there was a strange man in the shadows outside Ruby's apartment, knocking insistently. She had opened the door a crack, intending to tell him in her firmest possible voice to go away, for Ruby already had so much to deal with. But then Ruby's door had opened, and the light spilling into the hall had revealed his uniform. Charlotte had frozen, terrified. At first, she'd thought the man was German. After all, she'd gotten accustomed to seeing German uniforms spreading across her city like a growing mold. But his voice sounded different, and as he spoke in low tones to Ruby, she made out a few familiar words. Sorry, flying, thank you. And she'd realized he was speaking English. So he was British then, or perhaps even American. He had to be, and he must be a pilot, too. There was no other reason an Allied soldier would be in Paris. Before she'd stopped going to school, Charlotte had overheard gossip from her classmates that there were resistance networks sprinkled throughout Paris. French citizens who smiled to the Germans' faces and behind their backs helped pilots who'd been shot down. She knew, too, that the penalties were stiff for those who were caught working against the Nazis. The men were most often executed, the women shipped off to prison camps in Germany. But Ruby was helping? Why hadn't she said anything? Charlotte had thought she and Ruby were friends, but friends confided in each other. Friends trusted each other. The only explanation was that Ruby saw her as merely a child. But Charlotte was 12 and a half now, old enough to help out, old enough to make a difference. Besides, she could keep a secret, even from her parents. Ruby could trust her. Charlotte was determined to prove it. She snuck into the kitchen, where she packed a small bundle for the airmen, a little cheese, some stale bread, sardines in a can. Ruby's rations weren't any more plentiful than hers, and though she knew her parents would probably notice the missing items, she vowed she'd simply eat less over the next week to even the scales. If she arrived at Ruby's door with food for the fugitive, surely Ruby would see how serious she was about joining her secret mission. Charlotte checked on her parents before she left to make sure they were sleeping soundly. Mama was curled on her side, her shoulder rising and falling, and Papa was on his back, snoring loudly. They were both deep sleepers. There was no way that she would wake them now as she slipped out of the apartment. A moment later, she knocked on Ruby's door. She heard shuffling inside, but no one answered. She knocked again, but there was still no answer, only silence from within. Finally, she rapped for a third time and said quietly through the door, "Ruby, open up. It's Charlotte. I know about your airmen." There was a moment of quiet, and then Charlotte could hear footsteps. The door swung open to reveal Ruby, red-faced, staring down at her. "Charlotte," she exclaimed, "what are you doing up?" "I know about your airmen," Charlotte repeated, presenting her carefully assembled bundle. "That's what he is, right? I've brought him some food." Ruby's face went blank, though Charlotte noticed her cheeks were still flaming. "I don't know what you're talking about. There's no airmen here." "Ruby," Charlotte said slowly, her feelings hurt. "I saw him." "Charlotte." "No, I'm tired of everyone treating me like a child. Mama and Papa act like I have no idea what's happening. But I see it every day. I understand way more than they think I do. And you, I thought we were friends. But friends don't keep secrets like this.
Ruby blinked a few times. Come in. She put a hand on Charlotte's shoulder. But you must be quiet. And you mustn't breathe a word of this. It could get us all killed. Her heart thudding, Charlotte stepped into the apartment and looked around as Ruby closed the door. The pilot was nowhere to be seen.
Where is he? Charlotte asked.
Ruby sighed. Charlotte, dear, I'm not keeping things from you because I believe you're a child. I know you're not. This war has forced us all to grow up. And I feel that we're friends, too. But some things are better not to discuss.
Why?
Because if you're ever questioned by the police or by the Germans, you could be in danger. I'm American, so they might be more careful in the way they treat me. But you're...
She stopped speaking.
I'm Jewish, Charlotte filled in. That's what you are going to say.
Yes, yes, Charlotte. And if there's ever a problem, I want you to be able to say you haven't seen anything.
But I have seen something. I saw the airmen. Ruby turned away, placing her hands on the kitchen counter and staring out the window into the darkness beyond. Finally, she turned back around.
Honey, if the Germans come asking, you need to be able to deny having any involvement in anything illegal.
Charlotte held up the care package.
I'm already involved. See? I'm feeding your airmen.
Ruby eyed the bundle.
Your parents will notice.
I'll tell them I ate the food myself.
They'll be angry, but it will be okay. It's better than him starving, isn't it? I know you don't have enough food.
I have some.
And now you have more. If he's injured, he'll need his strength back, right?
Charlotte could see Ruby wavering, so she pressed on.
Ruby, I hate being helpless. There's not much someone my age can do to assist the Allies.
It's not just people your age, Charlotte. I feel helpless, too.
Then let's help together.
Charlotte was certain Ruby was about to say no, but then there was a mighty crash from the back of the apartment. Ruby ran toward it, and Charlotte ran after her. In the bedroom, they found a scene that would have been laughable if they weren't both so on edge. The airman was half buried in a mound of clothes on the floor outside Ruby's wardrobe. Charlotte realized in an instant that Ruby must have hidden him there when she heard a knock at the door, and he'd somehow managed to fall out. Dexter, Ruby said loudly, rushing to the airman's side. Dexter, are you all right? To Charlotte's relief, the airman was awake, and he struggled to sit up, his face red. He mumbled something that Charlotte couldn't understand. Ruby replied in English, and it was then that he noticed Charlotte. His eyes widened.
He said he was feeling a bit weak, Ruby said, turning to Charlotte.
I think he may have lost more blood than he realized.
How did he come to be here?
I was just about to ask him that when you knocked on the door, Ruby said. Now let me explain to him who you are and that you don't mean him any harm. She turned back to the man and said something in rapid English. He glanced up at Charlotte once more and smiled, almost shyly.
Merci, he said with an awful accent. Merci beaucoup.
Ruby turned back to Charlotte. I explained that you brought him a bit of food and that you're a friend who can be trusted. Now, do you think you can help me get him up? Charlotte moved quickly to the airman's side. Up close, he smelled of grease and grass. He was breathing shallowly. There were beads of sweat on his tanned forehead, and his eyes were glassy.
Just grab him under his left arm there and help me lift, Ruby said. We'll take him to the dining table, all right?
Charlotte nodded, and on the count of three, they hoisted the man, who was heavier than he looked, and helped him into the other room where he collapsed into a chair. He looked terrible, but he was sitting upright, his eyes open, which was an improvement from a few minutes earlier. Ruby said something to the airman again, and he smiled, first at her, and then at Charlotte. Charlotte found herself blushing. He wasn't so very many years older than she was.
I thank you for helping me,
he said in broken French, turning to Charlotte. I know it is danger. Charlotte smiled and said carefully in English, You're welcome, just like Ruby had taught her. Then she turned to Ruby and said, Perhaps it is better for him to speak in English? You can tell me what he says. Ruby translated this to the airman, who nodded and began to talk. They went back and forth for a few minutes, and Charlotte caught familiar words here and there, but not enough to piece together the story. He says he's a pilot in the British Air Force, Ruby finally said, turning to Charlotte. He was on a mission over the eastern part of France when he was shot down. He managed to parachute out, and then he hid in a barn while the Germans searched the woods for him. At night, he found a river and followed it west using a compass in his flight kit. He just knew he had to make it to Paris.
Why? Charlotte whispered. Paris is crawling with Germans.
One of the other pilots in his squadron had been shot down before, and he'd been saved by a network who helped him to escape through a pass in the eastern Pyrenees Mountains into Spain. He knew that if he came to Paris, he'd have a chance of returning to England.
But why here? Charlotte asked. Why your door?
Because, Ruby said, swallowing hard and then hesitating, casting another glance at the pilot. He says the man who lives in this apartment helped the other pilot. Charlotte stared at Ruby.
Monsieur Benoit?
Ruby hesitated. I shouldn't be discussing this with you, Charlotte. I don't want you to—
I saw him,
Charlotte interrupted, cutting her off. What do you mean?
He was in the hallway at night. He placed some sort of parcel into the closet in the hall.
Ruby went still. What closet in the hall?
It's hidden. It's just across from your doorway. I can show you, if you'd like.
Wait. Ruby glanced at the airman, who was looking back and forth between the two of them with a blank expression on his face. You're telling me that you saw Marcel placing a parcel in a hidden closet? Why didn't you tell me? Charlotte averted her eyes.
I thought perhaps you knew? I thought you were in on it.
No, Ruby said softly. No. It seems I'm the only one who's been living in the dark here. The pilot interrupted, saying something rapid in English and gesturing to the bundle of food on the table. Ruby pushed it toward him. Then she jumped up from the table to retrieve a can opener, a fork, and a glass of water. He says he hasn't eaten since his plane crashed, she told Charlotte. He's starving.
Merci, the pilot said again, nodding at Charlotte and pointing at the food. Very hunger.
He dug in, wolfing down the bread first, then the cheese, and finally the sardines. He sighed when he was done and leaned back, closing his eyes.
I think he is badly injured, Charlotte said softly. She'd
been studying him while he ate. Though the kitchen wasn't warm, his skin was pale and clammy.
Yes, I think so too.
Ruby sounded calm but concerned. She spoke to the pilot, and he shook his head and said something quickly. Ruby spoke again, her tone gentler this time, and finally, the pilot glanced at Charlotte, and then back at Ruby, before nodding reluctantly. He unzipped his suit, and winced as he wriggled out of the top half, exposing a torn and bloodied undershirt. He peeled that off, too, and Charlotte and Ruby gasped in unison as they saw the giant oozing gash across his right shoulder. Dried blood was caked all the way down his chest.
What happened? Charlotte breathed. It looked like the kind of wound a man could die from.
Ruby exchanged a few sentences with the pilot and turned back to Charlotte with a grim expression. He thinks a bullet went through his shoulder. He was shot before he bailed out. She glanced at the pilot once more, then leaned in to add in a whisper to Charlotte,
I'm very concerned that it is infected, but I don't know how to treat it, and it's too dangerous to call for a doctor. Monsieur Benoit will know what to do, Charlotte nodded decisively.
But I don't know when he will be home. He has no way of knowing that this pilot is here. If he doesn't make it back for a few days?
The pilot could die.
Charlotte glanced at the man, who looked back at her blankly. She was glad he hadn't understood.
Do you know where Monsieur Benoit goes? Or who he's working with?
I didn't even know he was doing any of this, Charlotte. You know more about it than I do, it seems.
No, I don't.
Charlotte's reply was instant, but then she felt guilty, for she had known more than Ruby, and she hadn't bothered to tell her. It seemed that she, not Ruby, was the bad friend.
My parents are friends with the doctor who helped you when...
She stopped abruptly.
You've met him,
she concluded instead. Yes, but we can't involve him in this. We don't know if he can be trusted, and even if he can, I'm not willing to put more people in danger.
Then what do we do?
Ruby was silent for a long time. The airman was trying to follow their conversation, but from the look on his face, Charlotte was almost certain that he didn't understand.
We wait, Ruby said at last. We hide him, and we wait for Marcel to come home. But what if he dies first? Charlotte whispered.
I'll do everything I can to reach Marcel, Ruby said, and I'll clean the airman's wound and care for him to the best of my ability. Beyond that, we'll just have to pray.
Okay, but you promise you'll tell me if I can help at all?
Ruby smiled. You can help. You can show me this secret closet. Chapter 12. August 1941. In January, just after Thomas had buried his mother, his squadron had begun missions over France, which was exactly the distraction he needed. Defending England's coast was important, of course, but playing defense wasn't the way to win a war. By bringing the fight to the Huns, the RAF was finally on the offense, which meant they actually had a chance. Before their first trip across the Channel in late January, the CO stopped Thomas, Harry, and the others on their way to a Nissen hut for a briefing.
"Don't even think about bailing out over France," he warned. "The place is crawling with krauts, understand? May as well go down with your plane if you can't make it out."
The warning should have made Thomas's blood run cold, but it was cold already. Now that his mother was gone, no one, except maybe Harry, cared whether he lived or died. He was acutely aware of that every time he went skyward. A huge map of the English coast and northwestern France was slung across the back wall of the hut, crisscrossed with red string. As he and Harry took seats facing the platform, Thomas noted that many of the airfields around London had string paths to a central meeting point in Canterbury, the launching point for a route across the Channel.
"Listen up, chaps," the station commander began, and a hush fell across the room. "We're bringing the war to the Germans now. It'll be dangerous, but this is a crucial step on the road to victory."
The CO spoke next, briefing the men on their flight positions, their target speeds, the enemy aircraft, and their mission goal, to keep German 109s from shooting down the British bombers that would drop their loads around Bologna, a coastal area crawling with Nazis.
"What do you think, then?" Harry asked later as he and Thomas walked briskly through a light snowfall back to their rooms.
They had just a few hours to prepare for the mission.
"Are we going to turn the tide, or is this suicide?"
Thomas didn't answer right away. The truth was, he didn't much care if he lost his life somewhere over France, as long as he brought some Germans down with him. But Harry, apparently reading his mind, wasn't having any of it.
"Look, I know you're in a bad way right now, but you're not alone out there, you understand. I'm your brother, and so are Jarvis, Reeves, Abbott, and the rest. And I notice you didn't ask me what I think, but in my view, things are about to change. Maybe 1941 is the year we win the war, right?"
Thomas chuckled at this, for they both knew it was false optimism. The war would drag on at least until 42. The Huns weren't going to lie down at the first sniff of defeat, that was for sure. The next morning, with a northwesterly wind at their tails and sunlight sparkling off the Channel, a dozen Blenheim bombers set off for the French coast with an armada of fighters. Thomas was just behind the right wing of the fleet as they crossed over the choppy waters, heading for a green smudge of land in the distance. As they approached, Thomas rose above the bombing height of 12,000 feet, ducking and weaving through the clouds to check for approaching enemy aircraft.
The skies were clear as the harbor of Boulogne came into view, and though there were 24 German fighters doing practice maneuvers some 50 miles southward, no one had noticed the British incursion yet. Still, Thomas was vibrating with anticipation. Someone could spot them at any moment. No sooner had the thought crossed Thomas's mind than the sunny afternoon exploded with whizzing black dots and puffs, anti-aircraft fire from the ground. "Damn it," Thomas cursed, expecting more. But no German planes appeared from the clouds, and none of the dark bursts hit their marks. A moment later, the Blenheims dropped their bombs into the port. It was hard to see what they'd hit, but from the percussive sounds of explosion and the belches of smoke below, Thomas guessed that they'd found the German vessel snug in the harbor. Well then, that was something, wasn't it?
"All right, boys," the voice came over the radio. "That's a success. Let's head back now, shall we?"
Slowly the Blenheims turned to port, and the whole aerial fleet followed them back out over the channel. In the distance, the British coast gleamed in the sunshine like a beacon welcoming them home. 7 months later, bombing runs to the mainland were no longer a novelty. They were the pieces that made up Thomas's life. Each mission was exhilarating in its own way. There were always Huns to look out for, enemy fire to avoid, strategic sites to target. The RAF boys were dogged, determined, undefeatable. But there were casualties, too. In late June, Harry had disappeared over France on a bright, perfect afternoon. It had been a routine mission, escorting bombers in and out, but the Huns had caught them this time, and there had been a dogfight. Thomas had managed to dodge the enemy fire, but he'd heard Harry's panicked calls over the radio. And he'd seen his friend's plane corkscrewing toward the earth, its tail breathing fire.
"Harry," he'd called back as the plane vanished beneath a blanket of clouds. "Harry, do you read?"
But the sole reply had been a sinister static. Thomas could only assume his friend, officially listed as missing in action, was dead. He had to be. The way his plane had burned, leaving an ominous shadow of black smoke, had shaken Thomas to the core. There was nothing he could do, and the helplessness was paralyzing.
"This one's for you, Harry," he'd said 7 weeks later,
as he engaged in a dogfight with a 109, sending the other aircraft spinning toward the yawning earth. Sometimes, he dedicated his triumphs to Harry. Other times, it was Oliver. Still others, it was his own mother, for he was confident that she was up there somewhere, looking down on him and gracing him with a bit of extra luck. How else could he explain the way he seemed invincible? He taxied in that night and found the flight instructor, Maxwell, waiting for him with a big grin.
"You'll never guess what happened, sir," Maxwell said as Thomas unfastened his straps.
"I'm a little tired for guessing games," he said as he climbed from the cockpit.
"Oh, but this one's worth it. It's to do with Cormac."
Thomas looked up, startled.
"Harry Cormac?"
"One and the same, sir. He's back, sir, alive and well. I'd suggest you get over to the mess right away."
Thomas didn't believe it until he'd laid eyes on his friend himself, 5 minutes later, after running full tilt across the base. There, just as Maxwell had promised, Thomas found Harry in full dress uniform, gaunter than he'd been 7 weeks earlier, but otherwise no worse for the wear.
"Harry?"
Thomas cried from across the hall, and his friend turned, smiled, and closed the distance between them, pulling Thomas into a bear hug.
"Thomas, you're a sight for sore eyes, my friend."
Harry's voice was scratchy but familiar, and Thomas felt as if he were looking at a ghost.
"I was sure you were dead."
Thomas clapped his friend on the back to reassure himself that Harry was actually composed of flesh and bones.
"I thought so too, but I went down near a farmhouse, and the farmer hid me in a storeroom beneath his barn for 3 days until the Nazis stopped looking."
"Who was this man?" Thomas asked in awe.
Harry shrugged.
"A fellow named Jacques. I never got his surname. He sent me to a butcher in town, who hid me for another 4 days,
and then a third chap put me in the back of his truck and took me to Paris, where they gave me directions to a safe house near a little art shop with sculptures of ballerinas in the window.
A safe house?
Well, sort of, Harry chuckled. It was more like a cupboard, really. It wasn't far from the Eiffel Tower. I had to stop for a minute and just stare, Thomas. It's like nothing you've ever seen before. The building, it had a huge red door in front, and inside there was a man up one flight of stairs who hurried me into a sort of hole in the hall. I was there for 3 days with just a little sausage and bread to eat, and on the fourth morning, a woman came to take me away. They gave me clothes and false papers, and I rode a train filled with Nazi soldiers all the way down to a town near Perpignan in the south. Then, and this is the most unbelievable part, Thomas, I actually walked right over the Pyrenees Mountains into Spain.
Thomas stared at him. Over the Pyrenees?
There's a mountain pass there just through a commune called Bagnols-sur-Mer. We made it past the border, and then the man who took us across connected us with railway workers who saw us to Barcelona.
I can't believe it.
I wouldn't believe it either if it hadn't happened to me.
Who are these people who helped you?
Harry shrugged. I haven't a clue. They went by code names, and it all seemed very secretive. But I'll tell you one thing. They're helping us win the war, Thomas. Before I was shot down, I rather thought the Brits were in it alone. But there are plenty of ordinary French people who are part of the effort, too. They talk about Churchill like he just might be their savior.
Thomas opened his mouth to reply, to say how astonishing this all was, and how glad he was that Harry was home. But he found himself too choked up, so instead, he just smiled and clapped his friend on the back again.
"I'll never forget any of it," Harry said after a minute. "And neither should you, Thomas. One of these days, you might be the one falling from the sky."
"I won't forget," Thomas said, though he had no intention of getting shot down over France. "I promise."
Chapter 13. August 1941. Ruby insisted that Charlotte go home. The longer she stayed, the greater the chance that her parents would awaken and come looking for her. And then, as quietly as possible, she moved Dexter into the closet in the hall. She was astonished to find not only that it was large enough to fit a man, but that it had been outfitted for just that purpose. There were blankets and a pillow inside, candles and matches, a few tins of food, even some civilian clothes. Marcel had clearly been at this for some time, which made Ruby both furious and proud.
"You'll be safe here," she told Dexter. "My husband should be home soon, and he'll know what to do."
"I don't know how to thank you, miss."
He was larger than he had seemed at first, a fact that became quickly apparent as he folded himself into the closet, wincing.
"You can do one thing to thank me."
"Anything, miss."
"You can stay alive. I can't have you dying on my watch, all right?"
She was trying to sound confident, but she feared that he could hear the tremor in her voice.
"We need you back up in the skies as soon as possible. You must promise that you'll be okay."
He smiled weakly.
"I promise, miss, and I've never gone back on my word with a pretty girl."
She could feel herself blushing as she shut the hidden door. It had been a long time since anyone had called her that. The next day was awful. It seemed to drag on forever, and though Ruby did her best to go about her normal routine, heading out with her ration tickets to stand in line, sweeping and mopping the apartment, writing to her parents yet again, her mind was on the pilot. Was he okay? There wasn't a thing she could do while it was light out, and she still had no way to reach Marcel. She waited until midnight to venture out of her apartment, standing for a long time in the hall to listen for anyone stirring. But the building appeared to be asleep, and so she crept to the closet and opened it by pushing on the panel Charlotte had shown her the night before.
When the door swung silently out, the scent of sweat and urine was so strong that it nearly choked her. She took a step back, coughing. Then she held her breath and leaned forward again, searching the darkness.
"Dexter?" she whispered.
"Miss." The voice was weak, tremulous, but hearing it filled her with a wave of relief.
"You're okay. Oh, thank God."
"I made a promise, didn't I?"
She could hear his smile in the darkness.
"Indeed, you did. How are you? Can I bring you anything?"
"Oh, I'm doing just great, miss. I suppose a bit of water would be nice if it wouldn't be too much trouble."
"Of course."
Ruby shut the closet, hurried into her own apartment, and returned a moment later with a full glass. How had she not thought to bring him water earlier? She stood in the hall for a few moments again, listening for movement in the building, before quietly opening the door to the closet, holding her breath, and handing the glass into the darkness.
"Thank you," Dexter murmured weakly, and then she could hear him drinking in big, grateful gulps.
When he handed the glass back seconds later, he added,
"And listen, I'm quite sorry about the, smell in here."
"I hadn't noticed."
"That's awfully kind of you to say, miss, only I know it's terrible."
"It's really not so bad. How's the shoulder?"
He hesitated.
"Oh, healing up nicely, I think."
Ruby knew it was a lie. "Look, if my husband isn't home by tomorrow, I promise I'll find help."
"I don't want to put you in any danger, miss."
Ruby felt a surge of gratitude and shame. "Dexter, you risked your life because you knew it could make a difference in the war. What kind of a person would I be if I didn't do the same?"
"You don't owe me anything, miss. Even this, hiding me at your own risk, is more than I would have expected. You're very brave."
"Hardly." In fact, she felt like a fraud taking any sort of credit for work Marcel had clearly set in motion. "Sit tight, Dexter. You're going to be okay."
"Thank you, miss," he replied softly as she closed the door. "Good night."
Marcel came home 2 hours later, just past 2 in the morning.
"Oh, thank God," Ruby said, rising to her feet as soon as he walked in. She'd never been so relieved to see him.
He looked startled to see her waiting for him.
"Ruby, what is it? Has something happened?"
"When were you going to tell me?" she demanded, instead of answering.
"Tell you what?"
"About the pilots you've been hiding."
Marcel went entirely still for a split second, and then he was at her side, grasping her arm so tightly she knew he'd leave a bruise.
"You don't know what you're talking about."
Ruby stood her ground. "The hiding space in the hall outside our apartment? The secret late-night meetings? How could you be doing something so dangerous right under my nose without telling me?"
"You can't say such things, Ruby. It's careless."
"I would have helped you, you know. You didn't give me the chance."
"Ruby, it's my job to protect you."
"Protect me? Marcel, I needed your protection and support when I lost the baby, and you left me entirely alone. This would give me a purpose again, don't you see that? If you really want to protect me, you'll trust me.
After all, there's a pilot in the closet right now, and I've managed to keep him safe for a day without you, haven't I?" He looked up in surprise.
"There's a pilot in the closet now?"
"He came in last night. He desperately needs medical care, but he's alive."
Marcel sat down heavily in an armchair.
"The more I tell you, the more danger I put you in."
"I'm hiding an RAF pilot, Marcel. I think it's a bit too late for that."
He sighed and remained silent for what felt like a long time.
"I've been working with this escape line for more than a year now. We get Allied pilots out through Spain."
"Through Spain? Who are you working with?"
He shook his head and pressed his lips together.
"Better you don't know."
Ruby gritted her teeth. "I thought you were going to trust me."
Ruby, we only know those who come directly before us or after us on the line. It's better that way. If any of us is captured by the Nazis, it reduces the number of people we're capable of giving up.
But surely none of you would betray the others.
Of course, that's the hope. But the Nazis use torture. Who knows who might break under that kind of pressure? And besides, there's always the possibility of the line being infiltrated by a spy.
If it's that dangerous, why are you doing it?
I have to. I can't just sit back and let the Germans win.
Ruby waited until his eyes met hers.
That's exactly how I feel, Marcel. You must let me help. Let me take care of the pilot first, all right? We can talk in the morning.
Is that a promise?
He held her gaze.
It's a promise. Now, go to bed.
Fine. She had the sense he actually meant what he was saying. And he was right. The squabble between them could wait. Dexter was the priority now.
Please tell him goodbye for me. Goodbye, and Godspeed.
Who? Marcel looked puzzled.
The pilot, Dexter. He's a nice man, and he deserves to live.
Marcel nodded, and then he slipped back out the apartment door. Ruby watched through the peephole as he opened the closet and helped Dexter out. As they headed for the stairs, she saw Dexter look back once with the shadow of a smile on his face. Marcel didn't look back at all. 3 days later, Marcel still hadn't returned, and the bad feeling in the pit of Ruby's stomach was growing worse with every passing hour. He had promised they'd talk the next day, so she knew he had intended to come back. Still, she reminded herself, that something could have come up. He could have been forced to hide, or perhaps to take the pilot farther along the escape line than he had anticipated. Ruby didn't know how it all worked. When there was a knock at the door just past noon on the third day, Ruby knew it would be about Marcel. She peered into the hallway, saw Aubert standing there, and opened the door slowly.
Hello, Ruby.
His eyes were bloodshot, his clothes dirty.
Come in, Aubert, she said. Marcel isn't here.
I know.
He followed her inside and waited until she locked the door behind him.
I have some news.
Something happened to Marcel, didn't it?
Aubert stared at her.
Ruby, he and I were working together on something important.
You were helping him with the escape line, she said softly. It was so obvious now.
He mentioned he'd told you.
Aubert took a deep breath.
I can't say I approve.
Aubert, what happened?
Marcel has been...
He stopped abruptly and glanced at Ruby, then at the floor.
Marcel was captured.
What?
The Germans, Ruby. They caught him escorting the British pilot you kept here. The safe house Marcel took him to had been compromised.
Neither of them said anything for a moment, and the only sound was the ticking of the clock on the wall.
All right, Ruby said finally. So we'll get him out. Surely there's a way.
Ruby.
And in the meantime, I'll help. I protected this pilot, didn't I? I can do it for others until he gets back. Ask him. He'll tell you.
Ruby, I'm afraid you're misunderstanding me. Marcel isn't in prison.
Oh no, was he put on one of those transports to the east?
Ruby had just begun to hear about political prisoners being shipped out of France to camps in Germany. It would be harder to retrieve him from there. But she had faith in the network. After all, if they managed to return pilots to Britain, surely they could rescue one of their own.
No, Aubert twisted his cap. Ruby, the Germans shot him. He's dead.
Silence fell. Dead? Ruby whispered. What about the pilot?
What?
What happened to the pilot? Is he dead, too?
No. He's been sent to Germany, to a POW camp.
But they killed Marcel,
There are different rules for POWs, and those they view as traitors. When Marcel wouldn't give anything up, they decided to make an example of him. He was a good man, Ruby.
Ruby looked at the floor for a while, processing what Aubert was telling her. If only she'd figured out something to do with the airman herself, could she have spared Marcel? Had it been her own inaction that cost him his life?
Ruby.
Aubert's voice cut into her thoughts. She looked up, breathless, but suddenly as clear-headed as she'd ever been. I must help. I must take over Marcel's work on the line.
No, Ruby, that's impossible. I can't put you in that sort of danger.
Marcel said he'd let me help before he left.
No, absolutely not. I couldn't put you in danger. I can't do that to Marcel.
Marcel is dead, Ruby said, more sharply than she intended. Guilt flickered across Aubert's face.
I'm still his friend, and he would want me to protect you.
It's not Marcel's choice, or yours. He shook his head.
I'm sorry, Ruby. You're an American. You already stand out here. You'd only be a liability to us.
But...
No.
His tone was firm now.
You should try to get out. I hear there are still some ships leaving for America from the Free Zone. Contact your embassy in the south and get some help there. You can find me in the back of the bakery on the Rue de la Comète if you need anything in the meantime. But there's nothing for you here anymore.
Aubert was gone before she could say anything more. Ruby stared after him before shutting the door to her apartment. She stood motionless for a few minutes, and then she crumpled to the floor and let the tears come. Marcel was dead, shot by the Germans. He'd been a better man than she'd given him credit for. If he'd lived, would he have let her help as he promised? Would they have fallen back in love once he was no longer hiding from her? She'd never have the chance to know. 2 days later, just past dawn, there was a sharp knock at the door.
Marcel? Ruby cried, springing awake.
And then she was hit by a fresh wave of guilt and pain. She'd barely gotten out of bed since Aubert's visit. She'd been caught off guard by the depth of her grief. After all, there'd been a gulf between Marcel and her for more than a year. They hadn't made love since before she'd lost the baby, and she'd had the growing sense that they would divorce at the war's end. But realizing that he had risked his life to save Allied pilots, and knowing that he had died because of it, made her look at everything differently. Certainly, he hadn't been the husband she had hoped for. But would things have been different if the war hadn't come? Maybe much of it was her fault, in fact. She should have been more prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt, to see him as the person she'd fallen in love with. Had it been her own restlessness that made her turn away so easily? The knock came again, and Ruby threw on a dressing gown and hurried to answer. What if it was Aubert, here to tell her he had reconsidered, that he needed her on the line? Instead, when she pulled the door open, she found herself face to face with two French police officers and two Germans in full dress uniform, one fair-haired, the other darker. She blinked at them in stunned panic before she realized that she hadn't done anything wrong. Well, except for hiding Dexter, but she doubted they knew about that. Even if they'd tortured him, surely he wouldn't have given her up. It would have been much easier to leave her out of the story altogether and explain that it had been Marcel sheltering him.
Hello, gentlemen, she said, trying to keep the tremor out of her voice.
You are Madame Benoit? The shorter of the two French gendarmes asked.
The buttons that ran the length of his uniform were spotless and shiny, his small hat on perfectly straight. His eyes gleamed as bright as his buttons. He was clearly pleased to be part of whatever this was.
I am?
She pulled her dressing gown a bit tighter.
We will need to see your papers.
Behind the little gendarme, the German officers were silent, their eyes boring into hers. The other French policeman looked uneasy, his eyes roving over the interior of her apartment.
Yes, of course.
She left the door ajar as she went to retrieve her papers from her handbag. The French officer inspected them first, and then handed them to the Germans who read them over. The dark-haired one snorted and handed them back.
"American," he asked in thickly accented French. "What are you doing here?"
She explained that she'd married a Frenchman before the war, that she'd decided to stay. The German pursed his lips and muttered something to the other officer, who nodded.
"This is very suspicious, you see," he said,
fixing Ruby with a steely gaze. His eyes were beady and empty, like a snake's. His French was impeccable.
"Why didn't you return to the United States?"
"I wished to remain at my husband's side."
"To help him with his traitorous work on the escape line?" the little French officer sneered.
"Oh, no, but surely those accusations against him were not true." She forced her eyes wide and wrung her hands. "Surely the French police made a mistake."
"We do not make mistakes, madame," the little officer said tightly.
Behind him, the fair-haired German rolled his eyes, and the other French officer coughed.
"Oh, I'm sure you don't," Ruby said quickly. "I only mean that perhaps someone falsely informed on him."
She batted her eyes. "It's impossible for me to believe that my husband could have been doing something so sinister, right under my nose."
"We will need to search your apartment," the fair-haired German said, and Ruby nodded. She suspected that was why they had come, and she prayed that Marcel hadn't hidden anything here. If only she'd used the last 2 days to search the place herself from top to bottom.
"Of course, gentlemen. Won't you come in?"
She fought to keep her tone even.
"I'm certain you'll find nothing suspicious. In fact, if you had searched our home before my husband was executed, he might have been saved."
The Germans pushed past the little Frenchman, barreling through the doorway. After a moment, the little Frenchman followed, muttering to himself. The other gendarme stayed beside her.
"I'm sorry, madame," he said softly,
and she nodded, understanding that some of the people collaborating with the Germans had no choice. She was surprised by the pang of sympathy she felt for him. She watched as the Germans carefully opened every drawer and cupboard, and as the little Frenchman tore through her dresser, flinging clothing and undergarments dramatically into the air. When he reached the wardrobe, where she'd briefly hidden Dexter, she held her breath. But he passed through quickly, ripping her dresses from their hangers and throwing them to the floor. It took them 15 minutes to complete their search, and when they were done, they returned to the doorway.
"It appears you are telling the truth," the fair-haired German said, "but we will have our eye on you."
"Of course, sir, I understand."
"If you are hiding anything, we'll find it," the little Frenchman said,
but this time the dark-haired German placed a hand on his shoulder.
"That's enough. I'm sure she knows that no one can hide from us forever."
He nodded to her crisply and turned on his heel. The others followed, and Ruby watched until they'd disappeared down the stairs. Only then did she allow herself to collapse, shaking, to the floor. As she pulled herself up shortly thereafter, though, using the door for support, she felt a surge of hope. Marcel had spent so much time making her feel useless that it was easier than she'd expected to behave as if she was. Perhaps he had helped her after all. Perhaps the foolishness he had projected on her was the perfect cover. Now she just had to figure out how to convince Aubert that she could use that to her advantage.
Chapter 14. October 1941.
It was early fall when Thomas was sent up just before dawn to fly rear cover. The bombers were to drop their loads on 2 German-controlled factories, 100 miles north of Paris, and then Thomas and the boys were meant to patrol the sky as their fleet returned to England, intercepting and engaging German fighters on their tail. Missions like this had become fairly routine, the RAF in and out before the Germans had time to scramble their fighters. This morning, as they flew east, Thomas's mind was wandering. The clouds looked strange and heavenly, as if lit from within. "We're lucky," he thought. "Most people don't get to see the sky like this." He made a vow never to forget it as long as he lived.
"This morning's a beaut, isn't it?" a pilot named Lewis radioed, and Thomas smiled. It was just what he'd been thinking. There was something undeniably magical about seeing the birth of a new day from the heavens.
"Peaceful up here," Thomas agreed,
making the turn back to the west just as ribbons of light began to filter over the eastern horizon. 60 miles ahead lay the edge of the French coast, and beyond it, a narrow strip of channel leading to the white cliffs of Dover. Always a sight for sore eyes, even when they'd been gone for only a few hours. The cliffs meant safety, and this morning, they'd be glistening in the soft sunlight, welcoming the RAF boys home. That's what Thomas was thinking about when a swarm of German 109s rose from the mist at the squadron's tail. Thomas's heart jumped to his throat when he spotted them. "Behind us!" he managed to shout over the radio before diving into the clouds in an evasive maneuver.
"Hold on, boys!"
someone shouted back, and then there were bullets whizzing everywhere, a whole swarm of them, buzzing and hissing. Thomas struggled to turn into the approaching 109s so as to gain a bit of an advantage, but it was useless. His squadron was heavily outnumbered. There were at least 3 109s on his tail. He pulled back on the throttle and pushed the spit as hard as she would go. But then there was a great clanging, followed by a jerking so severe that it felt as if Thomas's spine had been jarred loose from his body. He cursed, knowing he'd been hit. He quickly evaluated the situation, trying not to panic. Could he still glide? After all, he wasn't far from the coast. If he wasn't losing much altitude or dropping fuel, making it back over the channel might just be possible. But the clouds below were coming closer, and a quick look at his altimeter confirmed that he was falling rapidly.
"Lewis, looks like I've been hit," he radioed,
but there was no reply, only the static of an empty sky. Had the others gone on and left him? Had they seen him plunge into the clouds and assumed he was done for? "All right then, Thomas," he said to himself as he continued to fall. "Stay calm. If Harry could survive a mess like this, you can too." But his forced serenity was shattered as another volley of bullets came at him, this time pinging off his engine. His windscreen was immediately black with oil, and thick smoke surrounded him on all sides.
"Damn it," he cursed.
There was no saving the plane now. He had to bail out before he got any lower. And so, praying that he could make it, he ejected and found himself alone in the sky for a frozen, terrifying moment, as his spit, belching black smoke, hurtled toward the ground without him. In the midst of his panic, he felt a surge of sadness for the plane. But there was no time to mourn a charred lump of metal. No, he was falling, and fast. He tugged the release on his chute and felt a bone-crunching jerk as it opened. Now there was nothing to do but float from the sky, feeling as if a bullseye had been painted on him. He braced himself for the gunshots he knew would come, but the air fight went on above him. Below, the earth was strangely silent. Thomas took a deep breath and forced himself to focus, to survey the surroundings as he drifted. He was coming into a heavily wooded area. The nearest road was at least 3/4 of a mile to the east, which meant that it would be a little while before the Germans could reach him, if anyone had seen him fall. The clouds were thick, and he had ejected right in the midst of them. It was possible that it had appeared to the Germans as if he'd gone down with the plane. Time slowed as he glided in for a rough landing, narrowly missing a cluster of huge trees and touching down in a small clearing. The moment his feet hit the ground and he found himself in one piece, he hurried to pull his parachute down so that it wouldn't call attention to his location. He wound it into a ball, dug a hole in the dirt, and shoved it in. He kicked the dirt back over it and pulled some felled branches on top of the freshly turned earth until it appeared there was nothing there. Next, he peeled off his sidcot and turned it inside out, concealing the markings of the RAF. He hurriedly pulled it back on and lowered himself to his knees in the dirt. He rolled around a bit until the flight suit was sufficiently scuffed, and then he added a bit of grime to his face for good measure. There, at a quick glance now, he might just pass for a French farmhand. At least until someone looked closely, spotted his flight boots, or tried to engage him in conversation. Though he spoke near-fluent French thanks to his schooling, his British accent would surely betray him. Thanking God for the preparedness of the RAF,
Thomas took out the escape kit that had been sewn into his uniform, a clear acetate pouch containing survival supplies, such as matches, water purification tablets,